From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 800-462-7413. Of course, along with your call, some topics to talk about. Tell us, Zorba.
Yes, the Mediterranean diet and how it may not only improve your cardiac health, but it may improve your brain. Excellent research, very important, something that everyone's going to want to learn about.
Excellent. And?
Nepal, the earthquake that's going on in Nepal, the issues involved whenever you have trauma, especially trauma such as an earthquake, either in our country or other countries. We'll give an update on
that. Yeah, Zorba is kind of an expert on Nepal.
Absolutely.
You've been
absolutely.
There
I've been there
time.
Several times and am very involved.
What's our recipe?
Breakfast pasta frittata.
Okay, and that's a guest recipe.
Absolutely, and if you like breakfast, Tom, do you like breakfast?
Not so much.
Oh, well, I love breakfast, especially on a Saturday or a Sunday, and this is a wonderful dish for something such as that.
800-462-7413 is our number, and Zorba, to the phones we go now with a listener in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, how can we help?
Well, I have a problem with GERD, or hyperacidity, and about 3 months ago, it started getting worse. I have been on Nexium, 40 milligrams once a day in the morning, and wasn't helping. It was at first, and then stopped helping. I avoid trigger foods, marinara sauce, spicy foods. I don't drink soda or alcohol. I do like coffee, but I do it now 3 or 4 times a week. I'm just a little concerned about it. My mother died of esophageal cancer.
Oh, wow.
She was not a smoker or drinker.
Uh-huh. How old was she?
She drank lots of coffee.
How old was she when she died?
She was only 60 years old.
Oh, gosh. Oh, that's a young age.
Oh, uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. I've outlived her. Uh-huh. I'm 65. Uh-huh. But it is getting worse, and I am concerned.
Sure. Have you got a gastroscopy? Have you gotten scoped at all?
Yes, I had an
good.
ECG a year ago.
Good.
I have a GI doctor.
Okay. Oh, well, let's put this all together. So
yes.
First of all, I don't know if I don't. First of all, with GI cancers, there's a genetic predisposition. So for colon cancer, we know it's about a 5% increased risk. Maybe more than 5% when I look at it, but there's a higher risk. I can't give you chapter and verse, mm-hmm. as we say. So what we do with colon cancer is instead of scoping people every 10 years, they get scoped every 5 years, and there's just a higher level of attention to that. For esophageal cancer, we don't scope people with esophageal cancer, at least right now, because the risk must be small. On the other hand, if you've got GERD and you've got something called Barrett's esophagitis or Barrett's esophagitis, which is a change, it puts you at risk for esophageal cancer. And they're scoped a little bit more frequently. It's a little increased risk, not a huge one. You don't have it. Otherwise, your gastroenterologist would tell you that. So I'm sure you don't have it because it's something that's mentioned. So now let's look at esophagitis, what you have, GERD, and all the discomfort. Are you taking Zantac in addition to your Nexium?
No.
Okay. Are you taking Nexium on an empty stomach?
I started doing that just this year.
Okay, so I have a couple suggestions. Number one, it's got to be on an empty stomach in the morning the moment you get out. Put the pills next to your toothbrush, brush your teeth, take your pill. By the time you've done that, if you're like me, it takes a while before you start eating something or drinking some coffee. Works better that way. Number two, Zantac at bedtime, over-the-counter, 150-milligram tablets, take 300 milligrams at bedtime. And do that. You can do that about a half an hour to an hour before you go to sleep. Some people take it when they go to sleep. It adds to that. Believe me, it really adds to it. It shuts down the way the acid actually works on the stomach. It's very different from the proton pump inhibitor. Number three, do you have your bed on little blocks at all so you're not laying flat?
Well, I have a bed. I can put the head up.
The head should be up all the time. Okay?
Yes, it is.
It should be up all the time. And then what I would do before, I would take some Zantac and I would take it with a swig of Maalox, the old-fashioned Maalox remedy. It tastes like chalk. It looks like chalk. I find it disgusting. But then I buy the name brand that's strawberry-flavored. It makes me feel a little bit better. I still don't like the taste of it. But when I know I'm going out to a movie or show and I'm going to eat late because I have GERD, and I take omeprazole, which is Prilosec, pretty much a lot of mornings when I know something's going on. I take a Zantac at bedtime. I take it with a swig of Maalox. It doesn't happen. So,
good.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And your risk, once again, is minimal if you've got a normal, a normal esophagus based on your gastroscopy. Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much. So. Appreciate the call at 800-462-7413.
Now, do you ever get GERD? Do you ever get reflux? No. Well, that's good. That's good. I get GERD periodically. My dad used to get it.
I could tell by
you. Well, my dad used to get it. It was awful, and that was before the medicines were invented. He'd come home. Mm-hmm. I can still remember he'd lay around the house in agony because nothing was invented but Maalox, and that would work for an hour. And when I first did medicine back in the dark ages, we didn't have these other drugs. If people came in with terrible GERD, we put a nasogastric tube down their stomach, which was not comfortable, and dripped Maalox continuously in the stomach to try to get rid of the pain. The pain was so bad. And these drugs are wonderful, wonderful by comparison.
800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in Hayden, Idaho. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
I have a question. I'm wondering how much I should be concerned about. My red blood count has been a little bit below the normal range for about 8 years, and my white blood count has been kind of falling below the normal range just for the last 3 years, not greatly, but somewhat. And I'm wondering how much I should be concerned, what are the possible causes, and what I might do to make that situation better.
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, your concern when we have anemia is always well-placed. That's why we work up anemia, because things can happen. So let's make an assumption. You've been tested for this. What have you had done? Have you had a colonoscopy?
You know, I have had a colonoscopy and everything. They found some benign polyps, but that's not yet.
Yeah, but that was after your anemia you had,
yeah,
it, right? Good. That's important because the first thing we look at with anemia is, do you have anything going on in your colon? Because that's how colon cancer can present, polyps can present that way and do it. Okay, so, and you've been tested for iron, B12, folate.
All that good stuff. My ferritin is low normal, about 53 is the numerical value.
Okay. Now, let's talk about normal. So what's your what numbers do you have? Do you know?
Yeah, I do. I'm looking right at right now. My red blood count is 4.4.
Uh-huh. What's your hemoglobin?
That is 13.4.
Oh, good. And your hematocrit?
41.6.
Yeah, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that.
Oh, but it shows like it's below the normal range.
Oh, so let me give an example.
Yeah.
The bell-shaped curve. We all know what a bell-shaped curve
is,
okay? It's a little bell. And when we set normals up, we set them up so that 95% of the time, that's the goal, the normals will take in 95% of the people who are normal. So 5% of the people, by definition, will fall out of normal range. 2.5% at one end, at the upper end, 2.5% at the lower end of people who are normal. So they're normal. And the goal is to try to pick up all the abnormalities. So what we do is we catch a number of normals. You're one of the people caught.
Uh-huh.
That's it. You are a variation of normal. You are a very special person. Mm-hmm. You are one of the elite. You are one of the one out of 20.
I'm an abnormal person.
Who fall out of... No.
Special.
No. You are a special person. There is nothing abnormal about you. You are special. You get to wear a star if you want to that says, I'm falling out of the bell-shaped curve. Now, if your number were 11.5, if your hemoglobin 11.5 or 10.5, that may point to something else that would be serious. They would do other tests such as a bone marrow. You are just outside of the normal range for your lab. All labs are a little bit different, so that's
fine. Would you say the same thing about my white blood count? It's a 4.2.
Yeah. Oh, that's fine. There's nothing. We don't worry about low white blood counts unless they fall. Well, unless they fall really low. I can't remember if we worry about them if they fall below 2 or 1. I mean, when white counts are like 0.5, they're serious. They're signals. But a white count of 4.2 is really fine. So in all seriousness, you are a variation of normal. That's it. And this is a very good example of over-testing. In other words, once you have the test for anemia, and I agree with that, colonoscopy, ferritin, looking at iron, looking at B12, looking at folate, and then you say, that's it. What else do we have? Some people have chronic disease, but you don't need more tests.
Would you say that I could improve the situation? I mean, I'm not concerned about it.
Okay. No, I don't think you could. There's no reason. Why do you want to improve the situation? What's the reason?
I just thought maybe I could improve my diet or something, bring it.
No, but why do you want – and this is – and I don't mean this facetiously.
Okay.
Why do you want to bring the number up? I mean, most people want to bring the number up because we think it should be up, right? Because that's normal.
Well, one of the reasons is, I do feel a little but it might be just a suggestive thing. I do feel a little tired at times, and I thought it might be related to the...
No, not at this number at all.
And I never feel a little tired.
Right.
Everyone, you never feel tired.
Never.
This guy really has a problem.
Right. That's right. What a shock. You live in the United States of America, and you feel tired. Oh, wow. Everyone else is full of energy.
So, I understand the bell-shaped curve.
What you're thinking of is exactly what most of us think of. We want our numbers to be within a normal level. I mean, it's not unusual. It's actually what everyone wants. Mm-hmm. And when the number feels out of normal, we wonder if there's something wrong. But you have to remember, these numbers are arbitrary. We made the normals.
And I'm a special guy.
Thank you.
I always knew that. Yeah.
Thanks for
your call. Did they ever give a blood test for humility?
Oh, you have a great day. Thanks.
Thanks so much. We appreciate the call. All our listeners are above normal.
That's right. I'm going to invent the blood test for humility. I love it.
800-462-7413, toll free to the phones again after Zorba. We talk about new research on the Mediterranean diet, and I know you're excited by this.
Oh, I love this. You know, the Mediterranean diet is the king of diets. And if I don't want to be sexist, I'll say the Mediterranean diet is the queen of diets. But it is the diet we should all be embracing. What does it consist of? Well, you go to the internet and you'll find out. But they looked at people who were, it was called an enriched population. An enriched population are people more likely to be at risk. 67 and older, they had high blood pressure, known heart disease, diabetes, something that is make them more likely to develop dementia. Not necessarily Alzheimer's, but any form of dementia, and they're older. One group was on the traditional American Heart Association low-fat diet, which, by the way, has changed. The Heart Association has woken up and smelled the coffee, and so they've started to change that, but the traditional low-fat diet that I harped about with everyone else for years. Next group on the Mediterranean diet enriched with a handful of nuts. Next group on the Mediterranean diet enriched with 4 ounces of olive oil a day.
Yeah.
Follow them for a period of 5 years.
Tell us what that original diet was. What is the healthy diet that's not the Mediterranean?
Oh, you mean
diet.
The low-fat diet.
Yeah.
The low-fat diet was don't eat fat. Don't eat fat.
Okay.
Don't eat fat.
Okay.
Get rid of fatty fish. Get rid of all the fat on your beef, which you should still do.
Yeah.
Use all the margarine you can, even though it has trans fats, because we didn't know that, because margarine is better than butter. And all the hype. Now, keep in mind, that diet came from the meat and potatoes diet in the 50s that was horrible.
Yeah.
So it was a diet, but we went too far. That's all. We went too far. So you take people on that traditional, that low-fat diet and the Mediterranean diet groups, and after 5 years, you then measure them with cognitive tests, memory, executive function, the ability to make decisions, mm-hmm. and then what's called global memory. And global memory is sort of how you react with your environment. The people on the traditional low-fat diet, Heart Association low-fat diet, had greater memory loss than the people on the Mediterranean diet. In other words, the Mediterranean diet people were better. Better memory, better able to make decisions, brighter, not the same risk for dementia. The people on the low-fat diet were worse. Their brains were worse.
5-year period? Mm-hmm.
That's how you would measure it. So considering the, how dementia is very important as you get older, and it's a risk, we should toss the low-fat diet and get rid of it. We should embrace the Mediterranean diet because it reduces heart attacks, strokes, and it's good for your mind. This is good news. It means there's something we can do to help our brains.
Yeah, it's hard to make that change, though.
Well, change in society.
I don't have enough fish in my diet. I have almost no fish in my diet.
Well, you should start eating fish. So you find a way. Now, in my house, fish in the summer meant smelt, which was awful.
Why would it mean smelt?
Because my father fished for smelt, and my mother cleaned it in the kitchen. It was disgusting and froze it. And the other part, the other fish were fish sticks. So it was smelt and fish sticks. That was what fish meant to me. But as an adult now, I love different kinds of salmon. You find a fish that you like. I love cod prepared the right way, you know, not breaded and fried. I will have a Friday night fish fry, but not most of the time. So find fish you like, Tom. Tuna is good. Canned salmon is good. Black and catfish.
I could eat that 2 or 3 times a week.
You should love it. That's great. You love it. Good. You know, you're the right weight. You don't eat a lot of fat in your diet, you know, because if you did, you'd be fat, and you are not.
I'm not. 800-462-7413. Our number, and Zorba, a Wentworth, Missouri listener, joins us next. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I have a question about talking in my sleep. Mm-hmm. Apparently, it's something I do frequently. Sometimes I'm aware of it because I'll wake myself up talking. Other times, my children will come in and say, "Oh, hey, Mom, you're talking in your sleep." And I'm wondering if this is something that occurs. What stage of sleep does it necessarily occur at? I know there's different stages of sleep. Are you getting a restful sleep if you're talking in your sleep? And why do I remember it sometimes and sometimes I don't?
Uh-huh. So you wake yourself up talking. What do you generally say
sometimes?
What do you say when you wake yourself up? Do you remember it?
Oh yes, I have remembered it, and other times. I'll have slept all night and somebody will say, "Oh, you were talking in your sleep." Uh-huh. My children go on vacation together. "Oh, Mom, you were talking in your sleep." Here recently, I was dreaming and I remember it distinctly. And I'm saying, "Get out, get out." And I woke myself up and my daughter came in from clear across the house and said, "Mother, you were yelling. Are you okay?"
By the way, that's not, sleep talking is not unusual. I had a grandfather who lived with us for a number of years, and he used to swear in his sleep. That's what I said. I was a little kid at the time. He had been in World War I and had part of his shoulder. He had shoulder pain and a bunch of other things. And I would crawl into the room when he was swearing, and I would talk to him to try to see what he was swearing at, and he would stop. In his sleep. He never woke up from his sleep. He would just stop. He swore like a sailor in his sleep. He swore like a sailor, by the way, when he was awake, too. It wasn't just in his sleep. And he was actually a sailor in World War I, so he fit that. But it's usually in a lighter level of sleep. It's not unusual. My wife Penny, God bless her, talks in her sleep, and sometimes it's in an early part of her sleep. She'll just be in the beginning part of her sleep and she'll talk. I've asked her questions and she doesn't answer anything, and nobody does because you're in the middle of some kind of a dream state when you're doing it. But this is just a sleep variation. You know, as long as you feel like you're getting a good rest at the end of the night, that's perfectly fine. You can also buy things like jawbones or Fitbits, which are things that fit on your wrist that'll tell you how often you wake up during your sleep. And sometimes that's useful. It just tells you what's going on. Tell your kids you're okay, even though they're going to come and help Mama.
You'll never believe that. it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
We really appreciate the call. And before we take a break, Zorba, time again now to hear from your favorite backseat drivers, the Grammar Police. Actually, Zorba, we're about to hear from a very covert and specialized unit of the Grammar Police. We rarely hear from them, but every once in a while they'll chime in if they feel the need to educate us. Today's infraction is handed out to us by a listener named John from Madison, Wisconsin, who I believe is a high-ranking officer of the Spice Police. He writes, Dr. Pastor, on a recent show, you commented that allspice is made up of, quoting, all sorts of spices. Wrong. Allspice is an individual plant that is a spice. It is the dried, unripe berries from the plant called Pimenta dioica.
Excellent. Excellent.
The
good
name allspice was coined as early as 1621 by the English, who thought it combined the flavor of cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves. Oh. Look it up.
Oh, look it up. I don't have to look it up.
You know it.
I just heard it. It's in my memory. Yeah. Cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves. You know, in our office, we give three things for people to try to remember to see if they have dementia. Yeah. I'm going to start using cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves.
Oh, so they have to remember that.
Yeah, they have to remember. I ask them 5 minutes
later. After
they draw
a diagram or something.
Yeah, after they draw a clock.
Yeah.
That's
right.
Cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves. Let's see if you remember by the end of the show, Tom.
We'll give it a whirl. You try me. If you'd like to wage war on Zorba's lousy grammar, send your grievances along in an email.
It is not fair.
Email to
Zorba@WPR.org or don't forget Facebook. And remember, I tweet.
Coming up next, we're on the phone with a guest chef. It's a good recipe, too. After that, some more of your calls. We have our medical mythbuster later in the hour. Some more of your emails, too. Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again, if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, recipe time again. And this week, we're in for quite a treat. Today, we have a special guest author joining in on the fun. Tanya Bastianich Monwali is the co-author of the new cookbook, Healthy Pasta, The Sexy, Skinny, and Smart Way to Eat Your Favorite Food. The book delivers 100 tasty pasta recipes, all under 500 calories. And she joins us today to share with us her delicious recipe for a breakfast pasta frittata. Tanya, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure.
How did I do with Bastianich Monwali, by the way?
That's perfect. Get that. People generally butcher it, but it's perfect.
I've been practicing.
I have to tell you, I was thinking the same thing as I'm looking at the book. I'm thinking, how did he get that all out?
Hey, before the show, 10 minutes.
I must tell you, the recipe is easy compared to the pronunciation of your name.
All the recipes are easy. Yeah, no, definitely.
So, Tanya, how'd you come up with this recipe?
One of my favorites. I love reusing leftover pasta. I think it's a shame to throw it out. You bothered to cook it the first time around, and I love frittatas. So the pasta gives it an added element of a little crunchiness, especially if when you fold the pasta into the eggs, a little bit sticks up, and then you bake it in the oven. It's one of my favorites.
So in terms of this, and in terms of favorites, it's a good recipe, I assume, obviously, to serve on a Saturday or Sunday. How long does it take to actually do it?
If you have pasta pre-cooked from the night before, this is like a 15-20 minute recipe.
So
it's really that
quick.
Longest thing is chopping the vegetables, honestly.
It's chopping the vegetables, that's right. So it's the longest thing. And Tom knows that because whenever he chops vegetables in the morning, he knows how long it takes.
You know, my breakfast, I open the cereal box.
Right, that's about it. That's exactly it. A little bit more in this book, because people associate pasta with being overweight, you know, and here it was, and the change in the food pyramid from pasta to less pasta. How did you decide to actually do this? And what's different about your recipes? I mean, 500 calories, how did you get to that? And how do you make those recipes overall? In other words, why would people look at this book versus a regular, we'll say, pasta cookbook?
Well, first of all, the pasta recipes are lighter in this book, and that's the whole thing. You know, you can eat a lasagna bolognese every now and then because somebody put in 5 hours of effort to make it, and it's delicious. But you can't eat like that all the time. Mm-hmm. And in Italy, pasta is a staple, and people use it almost as a medium or as a vehicle for the condiment. Here in the United States, pasta is usually drowned or smothered mm-hmm. in a meat sauce or a tomato sauce. And in Italy, that's not how they eat it. They have a little bit of pasta with a little bit of vegetable or a little bit of pasta with a little bit of protein. And it's a very satisfying, fulfilling meal, A, because it tastes delicious, so you're not just eating steamed vegetables or something to try mm-hmm. and stay lean and trim and maintain your weight, and B, because it fills you up, actually. It's really satisfying. So a little bit just how we handle pasta in this book in general, where it becomes the protagonist. We carefully looked at a box of pasta. Mm-hmm. It feeds 6 people. That's 75 grams of pasta each. That's mm-hmm. 250 calories of just pasta. Mm-hmm. And then another 250 calories maximum, because some of these recipes are even under 400 calories per portion. But 250 calories maximum of a condiment, as we like to call it, because a sauce has a connotation of something that's just slathered all over the pasta. And uh-huh. that's not what these recipes are.
I think you bring up a very good point. Pasta in and of itself is really good. It's too much pasta is not what you're looking for. You're looking for a balance.
Right, and a heavy sauce. So like when we start our sauces in this book, we start with a little bit of olive oil, and then we begin to saute, but we use ladled from the pasta water that you're boiling your pasta in, we use that water. It's starchy, it's salty, it's delicious, and it helps create the sauce, wilt down the vegetables, and you're using less olive oil. And not that olive oil is bad for you, but it does have fat and it does have calories. And then we save a little bit of the olive oil for the end, where then you drizzle it on top and you get maximum flavor with the least amount of fat and calories. So it's also about smart cooking.
Yes. Engineering.
Yeah, we point to a lot of tasty ingredients. So sun-dried tomatoes, not the ones that are soaked in oil, but the ones that are really dried, and you reconstitute them yourself. They're full of flavor, almost 0 calories. Capers, using really sweet San Marzano tomatoes, that adds to the flavor of the sauce. So it's just like taking a minute and thinking it through. It's really a lot of just smart thinking on how to make the sauce to go with the pasta.
I like it. I like it. So let's do breakfast pasta frittata. 383 calories per serving. That is wonderful. Start out with 3 tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil. 8 ounces of turkey breakfast sausage links removed from the casing. So that doesn't take too much time, I assume. You just sort of squeeze it out.
You can take a knife and just slit it down the middle and pop it out.
And pop it out, really. Medium red bell pepper, 2 cups of chopped scallions, some kosher salt, 5 large eggs. And then you add 5 large egg whites, so you're adding more protein to the recipe without adding more cholesterol. A 1/2 cup of non-fat dry milk. Use 2%, 1%. What do you use?
You know, non-fat, so 0. But, you know, you can use what you have in the house. It just changes the calorie count mm-hmm. a little bit.
Okay.
That's all.
And so that's really all protein in there. And a little bit of sugar, of course, because milk is sweet. Cup of fresh Italian parsley, 1/2 cup of grated mild cheddar cheese, 1/4 cup of freshly grated Grana Padano. Now, what is Grana Padano?
It's a granular cheese.
Okay.
Its cousin would be Parmigiano Reggiano, but Parmigiano Reggiano can only be made in a specific area around mm-hmm. Parma. And this is a little less sharp and crystalline uh-huh. than Parmigiano Reggiano, so I find it is better to cook with, actually,
okay.
to put at the end of a hot dish.
Okay, so we'll get that. 8 ounces of spaghetti or other long pasta cooled and cooked. So let's make the recipe. Preheat the broiler, very important. In a medium nonstick oven-proof skillet over medium heat, add a tablespoonful of olive oil. And the nonstick makes a big difference because then you can use less oil. When the oil is hot, add the sausage, cook and crumble with a fork until cooked through about 4 minutes. Remove to a small bowl, add the bell pepper to the skillet, cook until tender, about 6 minutes. Add the scallions, cook until wilted, 3 minutes. Scrape the sausage back into the pan with salt and pepper. I like the fact that you put in the exact minutes, and I have a timer that I use next to my stove when I'm looking at recipes, and some recipes are very forgiving, but I like the fact that this recipe is useful because you're looking to develop the texture of the food.
Yes, and layer the flavor. So you use a little bit of oil, and then obviously the sausage has left a little bit of fat in the pan. You're not adding any more fat, and
right.
you're actually cooking the vegetables yeah. in that. So it adds another texture, a layer of flavor.
Yeah, it is excellent. Then in a large bowl, whisk together the eggs, egg whites, and milk until smooth. Season with S&P. Whisk in the parsley, cheddar, and grano padano, which I'm getting from Italy, reserving one tablespoonful of each cheese for the top of the frittata. Then heat the skillet over medium heat. Add the remaining two tablespoonfuls of olive oil. Add the spaghetti to the sausage and veggies. Stir to coat with oil. Cook, stirring occasionally until the spaghetti is golden in places. That's about 3 minutes. Pour in the egg mixture. I'm getting hungry right now. And let it cook until the bottom is set. And that's about 6 minutes. That's over a medium heat at that point?
Yes, medium heat, because then you're going to put it in the oven. So you don't need to cook it all the way through.
Right, and you've got to be careful not to burn it. So make sure
you don't want the bottom burn.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Sprinkle the top with the remaining two tablespoonfuls of grated cheese. Broil until the top is golden, but not dry or wrinkly, and the frittata is cooked. That's about 3 or 4 minutes, and you must watch. All broilers are different, and basically the space between the top shelf and the broiler is also different. Let it cool in the pan for 10 minutes, then slide into a cutting board. Cut into wedges and invite four of your best friends over for breakfast.
That's the other part. That's it. Perfect.
It is delicious. I love this cookbook. And I like your idea that pasta then becomes, I like the idea of condiments and getting rid of the word sauce, because you're right. Sauce we associate with calories and other things. Great cookbook. Great recipe.
Thank you so much.
You know, I bet other people want to have a copy of this recipe.
Yeah, to get one.
go to zorbapastor.org. You can find this recipe, other recipes. It's a wonderful recipe. I know that I went over it quickly, but I think you get the idea. Mm-hmm. It's healthy pasta. That's zorbapastor.org. Find us through Facebook, and remember, I tweet.
Yeah, and you can also find out more about Tanya's new cookbook, Healthy Pasta. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, we welcome a listener now in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, how can we help?
Well, I'm a big fan of your program, as so many people are, and thank you for the very, very good work.
Thank you so much for saying that. We really appreciate it. A reason I called a couple of weeks ago,
You had mentioned somebody's talking about cilantro and how they didn't like the taste or whatever it was. And I took a little bit of issue with your response, because you and the kind doctor had good fun, and the bottom line was you just said, oh, well, those are just picky eaters or something, and had some good yaks and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
That must have been Zorba doing that.
No, you both were in on it.
No,
you're part of the town. You're trying to shirk your responsibility here.
So I looked into it, and lo and behold, I found out that I wasn't alone in the world on this, because when I did a search, millions of people out there hate cilantro. There's websites hating cilantro. There's actually haiku poem forums on anti-cilantro. Well, it's brought the attention of a number of PhDs and doctors about the country and experimental people that there seems to be some people think it's a genetic predisposition, because the olfactory receptor gene ORCA2, by the way.
Oh, ORCA2,
of course.
It actually
heightens their sensitivity
to cilantro.
To certain things, yes. Uh-huh. But some people have a duplicate. So they're actually twice as aware of it. And it's really caused by a fat molecule called, it's an aldehyde.
Oh.
Now, people that hate cilantro, and I guess both two of you both find it fine, everybody says it tastes soapy.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's because aldehydes are used in everything from hand lotions to soap and all those kind of things. So there's like a physiological, chemical connection. It's got nothing to do with anybody's private taste. And when you start thinking about an aldehyde, well, how about formaldehyde, see? So there's all kinds of things going on there, and I just thought I'd...
Well, you know, I must tell you, They
this
have
is
a,
the, this is the world's top expert on cilantro on the phone.
And I have heard that there might be something, but I must admit I've never done a scientific search to find that out. I do know the world is divided into cilantro lovers and cilantro haters. But the fact that there's a genetic predisposition to this is very interesting. Well, thank you. Now, are you pro-cilantro or anti-cilantro? Where do you fit genetically into this?
I just can't eat it. It tastes like soap. They even quoted Julia Child, of all people, when they asked her about it some years ago. She said she hates it, and if she saw it in her food, she'd pick it out of the food and throw it on the floor.
You know what? If Saint Julia says that, that means it's true. It's gospel. So.
And if you Google it online, it's amazing. There's thousands and thousands of hits. So I just wanted to say I'm not a finicky eater, and you two had a lot of fun, but I thought, I think maybe they need a little bit more information.
or maybe a lot more information.
I mean, my goodness, they've got thousands of haikus written about it. I mean, it's amazing.
It's over the top. Thank you.
17%, by the way, on average, depends on what part of the earth you live on. It seems like about 17 to 20% of people have an aversion to that.
You know what?
There's the numbers.
There's a PhD in here somewhere. I know that. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
I really appreciate the call. Are we out of time? I guess we have a little time. And before we take a break, Sorba, let's take a Facebook question from a listener named Chris in Missouri. He writes, "Hi, Doctor. I'm a huge fan of your show and have heard you talk about the Mediterranean diet many times, so I decided to look into it. I have an awful diet, which consists of mostly chips and soda, and have decided I need to take back my body from addiction. I've noticed that in the Mediterranean diet, there's wine. My faith calls for no alcohol, so what do I do? Do I need to drink wine to feel the full effects of my diet?" And this is really an hour on the Mediterranean diet.
And the answer is no. No, wine is just a usual part of the Mediterranean diet. Some people drink, some people don't. And by no means do you have to replace it with anything. It's just a common thing that's used, sitting down, having a glass, not a pint, a glass of wine with food is a common thing. But I don't think it's part of it. And frankly, when they do the studies on the Mediterranean diet, they do not include wine in the studies. That's not part of it.
I have a question for Zorba. He's ready to help. Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or do it through Facebook.
Coming up, an interesting topic to talk about. You'll want to stay with us for that. More of your calls, of course, on our Medical Mythbuster 2. Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. But Zorba, before our next call, the tragedy in Nepal, we're talking about that for a few minutes. I know you're an expert on Nepal. You've been there a number of times on missions. Let's talk about it a little bit.
The tragedy is sort of beyond what you can imagine, because here you have a country that is as poor as Haiti. An earthquake comes and goes, but here you have not one earthquake, but more than one earthquake. Yeah. You've got tremors, secondary tremors. You've got hillsides. Nothing is flat. You've got huts that are on the hillside. You know, the death rate continues to climb, and it's a problem. It's a problem with food and water. I've been there several times on medical trips where we've gone to very, very remote areas, not reachable. There are no roads. The only way you get there is by walking there or on a small horse, which is sort of like a burro. And it's just simply disaster for the people there.
What are they doing now?
So the real issues are, the first thing is search and rescue. Are there people that they find? And then you periodically hear about somebody has been under the rubble for 5 or 6 days and saved. And those, of course, are the exceptions. Most people, you know, if they're not rescued within 24 to 48 hours, they're not there. You have other people that will never be found. And then you've got the secondary issues of the health problems that come up. The fact that they don't have an infrastructure, so even delivering medicines basic food and calories, very, very problematic.
This is not flat land. This is difficult to get to,
right,
and must be horrible to try to deal with.
Very, very difficult. In fact, one of the people who I know went to a village that she has supported, and the first village she went to she does birthing, so she develops ways of women to, you know, to have safer births. That village that she's worked in for years was totally destroyed. Doesn't exist at all. And I just recently got an email from her. She said, just wanted to know we're all okay. Very frightening out in the remote village. Our team was setting up birthing tents for women ready to get birth when the next earthquake and tremors hit. We grabbed the children and the women, ran out into open spaces as bricks were falling, and the pregnant women were brought safely out of the tent, but they were in labor. So, you know, it's sort of beyond comprehension.
And this, just like so many other things, comes into the news. Horrible, horrible, and 3 days later, we're on to something
else. Exactly, exactly, because we're on the next news cycle. But the fact is, this is a country that is extremely poor, will continue to need help. We're going to post some areas on our website if people want to help, where they can actually go and actually do that. But I think it's important to realize, like you said, that even though the news cycle may go on to something else, the problem still continues. And this is a country that is beautiful, wonderful people who are going to continue to have problems for some time to come, and there are ways that we can help, and people may want to.
800-462-7413 is our number. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is in Montreal, Wisconsin. Hi.
Good to be with you.
Sure. How can we help?
All right. I am having a post-rotator cuff surgical issues. It started with intense pain. I went down skiing, fell into my right shoulder, an audible crunching sound, and I started to feel better. I still have, and do at this moment, have some degree of pain. Sleep is a difficult thing to come by. Now, this is slowly improving, but I'm tired of living like this. I'd like to get a good night's sleep. Range of motion is a non-issue. I hope yours is as good as mine. But I can't talk with my right arm because I wave it and I feel pain.
Uh-huh. Now, have you gone to see anyone for this?
I'm stressing this is post-surgery. Mm-hmm. I did go to see the surgeon again. He gave me one round of hydrocodone and a folder on frozen shoulder.
Uh-huh.
The boys at Coffee tell me I had something called adhesions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm desperate.
Uh-huh. The boys at Coffee, you mean? I like that. The boys at Coffee.
Yeah. I've got a half a dozen middle-aged people that have endured just about everything.
Okay. Have you had a steroid injection into the shoulder?
No.
You might want to consider that. A lot of times a steroid injection into the shoulder can make a difference. One or two steroid injections can decrease the inflammation in the shoulder, and that might help. That is an option, because this might not have anything to do with the rotator cuff surgery, but might have to do with arthritis that has occurred in the shoulder concurrently with the rotator cuff injury. So I would recommend a steroid injections, one or two in your shoulder, to see whether or not that would do something. That's number one. Have you gone for acupuncture?
No, but that has crossed my mind.
I think I would try a round of acupuncture, which might be 3 to 6 sessions, and see if that would work. All these things looking not at a diagnosis, but a way to reduce the pain that's there. Have you tried a drug called gabapentin?
Sounds like something I drink.
Yeah, it does sound
No, I have not.
Gabapentin is a drug that's used in chronic pain, especially neuropathic pain, but it's a remarkable drug. And for some people, it's not an opioid, it's not addictive, it's not habit forming. And for some people, 100 milligrams to 300 milligrams, up to 3 times a day, can just reduce and tamp down those pain receptors. People can be on it for 3 to 6 months and their pain gets better. they get more movement, and that can make a difference. So hopefully one or all of these things might help with your shoulder. I don't agree with the boys. Did you say the boys in the band or the boys?
The boys at coffee.
The boys at coffee. That this is an adhesion, because with an adhesion, you have a decreased range of motion, and you've got normal range of motion.
Now, you know what? What I found most striking was when I fell into my shoulder, I had an audible crunching sound.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And then things started to get better.
Yeah, it's nobody likes to have a crunching sound in their body ever.
Oh.
So.
Oh.
So good luck to you. Try all those things and let us know what happens.
Well, thank you, Dr. Z, and I'll keep you posted.
Okay,
thanks so much for the call. At 800-462-7413. And Zorba, time again now for our medical myth buster. Today's curious question comes from a listener, Adam, of Helena, Montana. He writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, here's a myth I'd like to see someone debunk. It has to do with butt chugging."
No. Butt chugging. Okay.
As you may have heard, I've never heard of this.
No, I've not heard of it.
Chugging is an urban legend with almost zero evidence that anybody actually does it. Supposedly, teenagers and college kids give themselves alcohol enemas, believing that they can get more drunk this way. But that doesn't make any sense. The liver filters blood. If alcohol is in the blood, that blood will go to the liver, which will filter out the alcohol. Yet, I've seen TV, in quotes, doctors look right into the camera and say that this is more harmful than drinking because the alcohol goes directly to the bloodstream without first going through the liver. Why would the TV doctors say this, Dr. Zorba? Please set the record straight for us and keep up the good work.
Well, first of all, I want to set the record straight. I am against butt chugging. I just want to let everyone know. I think that that's irresponsible drinking through your... No, of course not. Why would I hear butt chugging? I've heard of a lot of things in my life, but butt chugging is not one of the things that I've... Who would want to give themselves an alcohol enema? Can you imagine? Let's set up the enema bag. Let's all get together and have a good time and watch the game and do enemas with alcohol? I mean, where does this come from?
I think he made this whole thing.
Well, but there are certain medications that are absorbed through the colon. So actually you can. And I must admit, I have not done the research to find out whether or not alcohol is one of those things, you know, and I don't know about these doctors who stare directly into the camera and say butt chugging is more dangerous. I think we can just come out on public radio and say, absolutely. If you're listening right now and you're an alcohol butt chugger, please stop doing it. That's right. Please stop doing it. It's not the proper way to drink. Responsible drinking is through the mouth, not through the anus.
Myths are like opinions. Everyone's got one, so send yours in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. This is the number one myth that I will remember for the rest of my life.
800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, a listener with us in Wausau, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello. Well, last week I was listening to a program of yours about the Mediterranean diet. And I just was wondering, my husband is a great walleye fisherman, and we always have so much walleye in our freezer. And I was wondering if walleye or bass, fish that are caught in the Midwest, can used in the Mediterranean diet.
Absolutely, 100%. And I'll tell you why. First of all, the Mediterranean diet is not staid and absolute, like, you know, you go to McDonald's and you get standardized food. You know, we have standardized industrialized foods. And if we look at food that's locally sourced, that's really part of the whole issue of it. It's often locally sourced food. So it's not one kind of fish at all. It's whatever fish is in the area. And the idea is that – not the idea, but basically what we have – what I think we found just through looking at this, it's locally sourced fish is better than industrially produced beef. And if you look at it globally, that's really what it consists of. And fish has different oil and different fat than chicken and beef. So the answer is yes, walleye is good and best. So how do you prepare it?
I'm going to tell you, you can't get big pieces, but I put it on some, like, tinfoil on a plain little pan, old pan. I put fresh ground pepper on it, and I broil it.
Ooh, perfect.
About 4 or 5 inches from the top, and I wash it. It's a slight crisp, but it never gets dry. It is wonderful.
Thank you. Thanks for the tips.
All right, thank you.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, before we sign off today, let's take a question from a listener named Adam. He writes, "Hello, gents. I was hoping..." Do you like that?
I like it. Hello, gents.
Yeah. "I was hoping you could give me your opinion on RSIUG, also known as reversible sperm inhibition under guidance. What are your thoughts, and why has it not gathered any traction in the United States?"
Well, I don't think it's actually done in the U.S. yet. It may be done experimentally. And the idea is that they put in, it's a birth control issue. So what they do is, instead of a vasectomy, they go into the same area in the male scrotum, they tease out what's called the vas deferens, which is what the sperm travel through, and they put in a plug. That's what they do.
Huh.
They put in a plug. So actually, instead of cutting it and making it, burning it off so you don't have kids, they put in a little polymer plug.
Does this mean that would be more easily reversible?
Well, that's the concept. The concept is that you put in the plug, and then when you want to reverse it, you take out the plug, and then you can have kids. It turns out not to be that simple. And the reason has to do with a few things. Number one, scar tissue. You put something in there, you have scar tissue. When we cut the vas, you would think all you have to do is take the two ends of the vas and, take away the part that you cut, and then just put them together, which is what they do when you have a reversal of a vasectomy in the U.S.
Yeah.
But the body, when the sperm do not go out of the body, male body, starts to produce antibodies to the sperm. And the antibodies then kill the sperm. And so this doesn't obviate that major problem. So in this country, what we do is we make a cut called a vasectomy. And then if you want to reverse it, we just put the two ends together and throw out the piece of scar tissue.
With limited success.
With limited success. But the same limited success would occur with this, because you still have the possibility of scar developing in that and antibodies.
Yeah.
Correct.
Interesting. Do you have an interesting question for us? Zorba is swimming in answers. Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or post it on Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0523Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.